Accession number 28625, reel 16.
Good morning, Mr. Strachan.
Good morning, Amy.
The last time we were speaking, we finished when you'd arrived in Mombasa on the 31st of December 1961, I believe.
That's correct.
Now, because it was Hogmanay, was there any celebrations then?
Not really. It would have been very foolhardy to allow any of the troops to disembark. So they decided that nobody would. And the local people were very keen to entertain us. But the pipe band, who were obviously very popular, they disembarked and played at function. And we just had to stay. And I think we might have had two cans of beer to celebrate it. We certainly won't forget that one in a hurry.
Was there restrictions, like when you were on a ship, you know, with regard to alcohol?
Yes, there normally is, and it's obviously wise to have it. And two cans of beer has been a favourite expression, really, wherever you've been.
And can you remember your first impressions of Mombasa?
Yes, a warm climate, green climate, obviously humid, Mombasa, busy, quite different to what you expected, and a lovely country, there's no two doubts about that. And we travelled up to Gilgil, up in the hills, and it took 23 hours to do that, and as you travelled and saw the different sides of life, the animal life, the agricultural life, when the train stopped at the station and all the poor little children would come out with their hands out wanting us to give whatever we did, money or food, etc. And I remember I've got three children and they were all young and I think they had measles on the journey, so they weren't eating their sandwich and saying, well, pass it through the window. I said, there you are, there's these hungry people and grabbing it gratefully and eating it, despite the fact that some might have landed on the muddy floor and the ground, and they would still eat it. And I think that my children, therefore, and thereafter, understood when I said, well, eat your crusts. But from that point of view, it was interesting to see.
And when you say that about the children, were you travelling with your family?
Yes, I was, yes.
Do you think there was any reaction maybe about your children seeing the natives and maybe the natives seeing, you know, white people? And
They would have seen white people. It wasn't strange either way. I think it was more a reaction from my children seeing African children for the first time. They were seeing a different culture, a different standard, a different attitude, and they obviously learned from it.
And when you seen the African children as well, were they dressed in a similar manner to how European children were dressed?
No. Bare feet and perhaps nothing on the bum and a sort of cloth on the top. I must admit, when they went to school, they obviously had a school uniform, which was a shirt and shorts and sandal, etc. But generally speaking, you know, they were surprised.
And were you travelling in military uniform?
No. Yes, we were. I beg your pardon. I'm sorry. Yes, we were. All the way up to Gilgil.
Okay. And how did they select the groups that were travelling? I remember you saying that you had to wait 4 days approximately.
Yes, well, every day a train came down from Gilgil with the regiment who were leaving, and we then filled it and we went back up. So every day, throughout the course of the 4 days, with four full train loads going up to Gilgil.
And was it Gordon Highlanders that were coming out?
No, a different regiment. Golden Guards and that sort of thing.
And when you first arrived in Mombasa as well, was it a built-up area? You know, like how ports now you would kind of think would be built up with maybe like the type of buildings we would have in...
Yes, just a natural port. In fact, it's a very busy port. freight and passenger and fishing and whatever.
So it wasn't too different from that respect to a European one?
Not really. Well, less modern, I would say. But no different in terms of volume.
And on the train journey as well, were you in compartments or were you...
Yes, each family had compartments and you had bench type, the back of the seat, bench type seat, went up to form a bunk, so you had two bunks. Four sleeping areas where five of us slept.
So you would have slept on the train for that?
You'd try to, but the humidity and the flies and all the other sort of things. And you weren't sort of acclimatized to the thing. It was quite an experience. And as I mentioned earlier, children having measles, they were feverish and needed attention.
And did you have attendants that could help you?
Not really, no. Definitely not.
And what about food? You know, you did mention food.
We did have rations as such.
And were they sufficient for the day?
Oh yes, adequate.
And you've mentioned your family, your children also having measles.
Mm.
And nowadays we're quite frightened of things like measles in children.
Mm.
How was it then? Was it acceptable or were you quite frightened as well?
You just had to accept it and just look after them generally until you got there for a doctor to see them. And we managed, no problem. A good wife and a good handler.
Okay, so when you did arrive at the Gilgil, was it in the, do you remember if it was the morning or evening?
Morning, mid-morning.
And what was your first impressions of it?
We were made aware that in that particular area, at that particular time, there was a little, like a ladybird sort of insect that was in predominance and about, and it contained some sort of acid that the natural reaction for people is to brush it off. So we were made aware that in so doing, so you would crush the little thing and the acidity from it would create blisters and whatever. So that, I distinctly remember on the platform hearing all these things. That was the first alarm of being in a different country and being aware of conditions and the what to do about it.
And did you ever see one of these ladybirds?
Oh yes, it wasn't a ladybird, but that sort of size and similar sort of crusted shelly markings on it.
And did they ever land in you?
No. They were about, but we were made aware, so therefore we looked out for it.
And who was making you aware? Was it just other men or?
The advance body, as I mentioned earlier, that we went pre-advance, then the advance, then the main, then the rear. And this is a group of people who had been ahead of us to get things ready for us to come along and move into our married quarters and barracks.
Okay. And were you in the rear party?
No, main party.
Oh, you were in the main party.
Yes.
And were you still, was it a colour sergeant?
Yes.
Okay. And so how did you get from the train station to your accommodation?
With local buses.
Oh, just a bus?
Yes.
I suppose it would have been. Yes. I was thinking of the trucks, but of course that was with the main.
Buses without windows and doors and things. A rickety old local bus, and that was it.
And how? And if you say it didn't have windows?
Well, I mean, you didn't need windows. They had sort of threaded wooden windows you take out, but it was really torrential rain. But the thing, it wasn't short supply. It was cool wind, drafts was welcome to keep you cool.
And was there many people on a bus? You know, it were.
Yes, about 39.
So it was a decent size.
A decent size, yeah.
And was your luggage with you as well?
Luggage went into the army trucks and followed you.
And was it a long journey from the station to the camp?
Not really. 15, 20 minutes perhaps.
And so when you arrived at the camp, what did that look like?
Well, it was a hutted camp, and it just looked a large area of huts and grass and weeds and trees, and it was a metal road around most of a narrow road. But we went, the soldiers went to the camp initially, and we went to our houses on Mariupol.
And were they still within the camp?
Yes, you could walk to them. It would take, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour perhaps to do it.
And was the camp, did it have a fence or anything around it?
A fence of sort, yes. But that didn't stop the, eventually the local Africans coming in and robbing us virtually every night.
And did they do that?
Oh gosh, yes. Definitely.
And did they ever bother you, or was it more the...
Not personally. The houses had bars in the windows. And obviously you'd have your windows open at night, but they were very clever in terms of using bamboo poles to reach in with hooks in them to pick whatever they could to the windows whilst you were asleep, you know, that sort of thing. They were even so professional and quiet that they would then go into the soldier bullets somewhere in tents and be able to pick whatever they could as they quietly and stealthily went about. And they would come up, there was a train went down to Nairobi at something like 4 o'clock in the morning, which they used to use. It was a clock in one, down in the other. And yes, they taught us a few things.
And what type of thing did they generally steal? Was there
anything that had a value for resale?
Okay. And this fence they spoke about as well, was that like a wooden fence or like a wire fence?
No, just a wire fence, just a symbol of your perimeter, certainly not big enough to prevent anybody coming in.
Okay, and was the married accommodation, was that still within the, you know, was it
no,
still...
No, at width, in its own sort of, like a little village of houses.
And so did you have guards or anything on the likes of your accommodation?
No, that wasn't necessary.
So you felt quite safe in it?
Yes, the children in a lovely school there with the British teachers, and they walked to school comfortably.
Is that far from the house?
No, again, 10, 15 minutes.
Okay, and your accommodation as well, did you have a maid or anything to help you?
Yes, I would say everybody had what they called a house boy or girl. Some would cook, would clean. And with very, very cheap labour, you could get a garden boy who would be very grateful if he got 10 shillings a week. But despite the fact that that's not very much, I mean, he was extremely grateful. It was invariably, if you got a good one, you looked after them.
And did they live in, or did
they? No. They walked from the village a couple of miles. And again, grateful to get employment.
And the accommodation you had, could you describe it to us as well, please?
It was a semi-detached bungalow style with corrugated roof, but inside, one of the most modern and comfortable houses that I recall having. A very good modern kitchen, a open plan sitting room, dining room, leading to your main veranda entrance. Three bedrooms, a bathroom, a toilet, and a huge hot water boiler, which it had to be, you know, for climate and the condition and the amount of family. And it was well ventilated, and you had a garden front and back, and you had to create your garden. It was just rough, they were new. So you had the opportunity to put up fences and plant things and design how you wanted things. Grow your own tomatoes and things like that.
And did you do that? Did you improve your garden?
Oh, indeed I did, yeah. Quite enjoyed drawing it and measuring it and then growing geraniums as if they were weeds. Yep. I mean, the climate was such tremendous warmth that if you just threw a tomato out at a little cultivation, you get tomato plants.
And was it quite easy to obtain things like tomatoes? And
yes, no idea. It's a natural area for vegetables and food. Yes, with lovely potatoes and all for the vegetable.
And in the garden as well, was the soil quite good for growing things?
Well, it was rain and hard and dry, and you never thought it would produce, but it did.
And did you think you were going to be there for some time that you went to this length, you know, to improve your garden?
Well, we knew that we'd be there for that, like 2.5 to 3 years. But within being there a few days, I was off to Zanzibar with my company, unaccompanied.
Okay. Can I just ask you one or two more questions about accommodation, maybe the schools, and then we'll go into Zanzibar. And was this army accommodation?
Well, it was houses built for the army by the civilians, and run and looked after and owned by them. We just paid a rent from them.
What I was thinking of is, you know how at times when you've spoken about army accommodation and how everything's been checked when you went in, checked when you came out, and there was everything was the same in all the houses. Was it that idea?
Exactly the same, yes. They had an inventory and you accepted it. It was conditioned when you went in and when you went out. But it was self-contained.
Okay. And was that a play area for the children as well then?
Yes, a good big area of school, but in those days the children played in the street. I mean, there wasn't any volume of traffic really, and tremendous freedom, and you had your garden. I was able to put up a swing, for example, for the, well, that sort of age. So yes, it gave you freedom.
And was it modelled like, maybe like how we would think of a street here? Was that how the...
Yes, an estate.
So there was other houses with other children?
Oh yes, yes, plenty.
And how old were your children then?
1961, if they don't know what to think. I was 7, 5 and 3. Yes, 2 years between, yes.
Okay, and there was a school with the British teachers? So
yes.
They were taken care of as well?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And you said as well that you were only in Kenya a few days, and then you got sent to Zanzibar.
Zanzibar, yes.
Why was that?
Well, Zanzibar was suffering from political spids and unrest, as it were, and having the affiliation to the British regime, we had an obligation to go there. And relieved half the battalion of Coal Seam Guards and just patrolled the area to maintain discipline and security and you know, the mere presence hopefully acted as a deterrent to the various factions which were there and couldn't get on like anywhere else in the world. And we played games and we tried to be spoilsports.
An announcement that you were going to Zanzibar, was that quite a shock to you?
Well, we had been forewarned about it on the ship. At that particular time, on the ship, before turning right in the Indian Ocean, we should have turned left to go to Kuwait, who was suffering at that particular time. But that was cancelled, and we instead went as planned to Kenya, and with a detachment in Zanzibar.
And with Kenya, was that like the headquarters or something?
Yes, down in Nairobi, that was the headquarters of the whole of the services area.
Okay, and so you were maybe like in an outpost up in Gilgil?
Well, Gilgil was where our battalion was stationed. The outpost was Zanzibar.
Okay. And had you settled in at all when you got this announcement that you were going?
Not really. And this is where the dependence of a good understanding wife was necessary to look after children, put in school, see that you're settled down. And I distinctly remember, in addition to all of that, my wife had a cracked wrist, which was in Stuk at that time, but it was a slight bit down to him, but they all managed.
Okay. And with our wrist, were there facilities out there that, you know, somebody could check on the wrist, how it was...
Yes, with a proper medical system. Yes, no problem.
Okay. So, how did you get to Zanzibar then?
We went by train, and then we went on the Said Khalifa, the Sultan's boat, that did nightly journeys across to the island.
And was that back down to Mombasa, or was it something?
Yes, to Mombasa.
So you had to do the 23-hour return journey?
Indeed, yes.
And did was there a large amount of men that went, or?
My company would have been about 140, 150 men.
And which company were you
Delta.
In?
Delta.
Okay. And so the train journey down, did you get rations and things?
Yes, the usual sort of packed rations.
Okay. And so you got the nightly boat mm-hmm. and you arrived on Zanzibar.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened then?
In the morning, and we took over from the Coast and Guards and marched into our accommodation. We had a wooden building there called the Ali Khan Bungalow, and it was there that the Ali and Rita Hayworth had apparently lived and spent their honeymoon. And this was a wooden building which housed the officers' mess and the administrative offices and schools and security places, whilst the men were in tents just a few yards from there, but actually within yards of the sea. You could lie in your bed and watch the sea lapping up the shore.
And this bungalow, was it quite an impressive place?
No. Just a big wooden building, barren.
And did you have a room to yourself there?
No. Nothing like that. I think we, in the building, the officer slept in the building. I had to do all the storeroom, and members of the sergeant's mess, three of us, well, the men that slept in tents, but predominantly a tent in Kathmandu, on the beach of the park.
And did you have good facilities in the bungalow, you know, like toilet?
Well, you had a toilet, yes, but we didn't have good facilities, really. You had there was a bath there, there were showers, and of course you could swim at any time of the day and night if you wished.
Okay. And what about your food there? Were you...
We provided our own food. The meat would be flown in from Kenya. The chicken and fish would come from the local produce. And we had emergency rations there for emergencies, obviously. But yes, we ate normally.
And emergency rations, what would that consist of then?
Sufficient, well, for 10 men for one day in a pack, which would include, you know, sausages or bacon for breakfast, and a soup for lunch, and then an Irish stew or a steak and kidney food for evening meal. But you seldom use, being a small island, we seldom used emergency rations. It was mainly fresh, although you had the usual thing of bully beef, which is renowned throughout the history of the army, and you had it wrapped in pastry, or had it fried, or had it cold, or whatever.
And bully beef, is that like a corned beef?
Absolutely, corned beef, yeah.
Okay. And the emergency rations that you had as well, was that like dried food, or was it like still proper food?
Proper food in cans.
And you said it was for 10 men for one day?
You got different side packs, a 5-man pack or a 10-man pack. And in addition to that, you had what they call a 24-hour pack. So that individually you got this little box that had everything in it, from toilet paper to a packet of salt and pepper to an oatmeal block or a wheat tin of beans, you know, that sort of thing. So fish and a bar of chocolate and boiled sweets. But that lay 2,000 calories that one would eat at that particular time.
Okay. Now, were you still in charge of all this type of thing? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yes.
So, like, for going into Zanzibar, mm-hmm. I don't mean how many because of the men you're there, but would you have had quite a few days' supply of these packs, or would it have just been, like, for one day?
Oh, no. You always kept a reserve, a reasonable reserve, in case of emergencies. But, as I said, I would collect a side of beef off an airplane from the local airport, and that would constitute a few days' rations, as it were, depending on the strength of people that we had to feed. And you would get your fish and your eggs and your chicken and that from local sources.
Okay.
And bread and, whatever your scale of rations were.
Did you ever have occasion to use the emergency rations?
Not really, not on a large scale, no.
Okay, and this camp that you were in Zanzibar as well, did that have a fence around it? Was it a proper, like, military camp?
No. It was on the beach, as I said, and you had a golf course beside it. In fact, we were on part of it. And you had a metal road which led up to the Aga Khan bungalow. But you were so near everything that was going on. It was really like just a camp, but certainly not a holiday camp.
And did you have to put guards around or anything?
We had our guards constantly, yes. Mm-hmm. And we had our kitchen, which was we had a wooden hall type hut in which the men would use as a dining room and a canteen at night.
Okay. And you mentioned as well that it was near the sea and there was a golf course there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Were people still playing golf on the course?
Yes. Hedrick walked past you. In fact, on the odd occasion, we had a few hits at the golf club too.
Okay. Did the golf balls ever come near the bungalow or anything?
Yes. I mean, it was so close. But you just respected what they did, and they didn't trouble you. They were mostly Europeans anyway. Lots of locals, but not of Europeans who were there for specific purposes. Bankers, engineers, and that sort of thing.
Okay. And so I know that you were there because, there was maybe problems there. But did you mix with, the Europeans who were in Zanzibar as well?
You could do. Quite a few people were invited to home and things like that for a meal. There's a good relationship, I think, between, I think that there's a different sort of Indians and Asians and, I forget the other one. But, I mean, there was certainly a mixture of races there. And English was spoken freely. Zanzibar was a tourist attraction. It was well known that there were three prices that you could pay for goods if you went down the town. You certainly never went down when an American boat was in. And you'd see this beautiful ship coming in across the coral break for it, and gracefully coming in, blue pond water. And that was American, so you stayed clear, and then you had the other tourists, and then you had the local rates, and that was when you thought you'd be classified as a member of the community, and you wouldn't be treated.
And was it a bartering system?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Lots of gold and jewels and things.